week of June 2nd, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 451, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Breaking news. Old Town Road is number one for the ninth week in a row. It's the biggest hit of the year. And tying into that, there's a music producer who has worked with Rihanna. I just learned how to say her name correctly, by the way. It's not Rihanna, it's Rihanna. That kind of blew my mind.
You know what? I think Toto should make a song about her.
Well, that's Rosanna Arquette, of course.
Okay.
So yes, there's a big producer. What is his name? His name is, where is that note? Where
Patrick did I hide? J. Adams? No.
No. That's an actor.
Okay. I had no idea. I don't know. I'm just reading the notes here, and this is literally breaking news. I feel like Walter Cronkite.
There's a where is it?
He's pulling copy off the ticker here.
Exactly, ticker. It's a big producer who's worked with the likes of Rihanna, and his producing name has also got a regular name. He's launching a radio station in Nashville called Young Country.
Ooh.
Where it's a terrestrial radio station. It launches June 6th, and it is going to include country from hip young artists like Kane Brown, who's sort of a rapper country artist and very successful in Nashville, and even Taylor Swift, and then hip hop and some other stuff because he feels like there's a home for that. We'll have to see if there's somebody in Nashville who says, you know what, I want to hear country and hip hop and urban, and I don't want to have to change the channel. But that's the argument.
Well, that's actually something that, you know, a lot of people, a lot of the music media have been talking about because of streaming. You have these consumers that will literally bounce between jazz and hip hop and then pop and then hard rock all in the same playlist.
Yeah, well, you know, it's producer Jamal Jones. Thank you, Michael, for finally finding that. He's worked with Rihanna, Nicki Minaj, lots of other people, country, urban, and hip hop acts we mixed together. And, you know, when I look at the Hot 100, I see a diversity of songs that come from all sorts of genres. And Top 40 used to reflect that. But now Top 40 is fairly narrow cast, I feel like. You know, there was an era in the 70s when AM stations were really diverse and pulled songs from everywhere. There was a time when Top 40 was really diverse and said, hey, if it's a hit country song and crosses over like Kenny Rogers or Dolly Parton or whatever, they didn't care. If it was a hit, they played it because they felt like most people wanted to hear most songs. So, you know, this is a step in that direction. Maybe we'll have to see.
Well, I believe we also have a correction from last week.
Oh, that's right. We mentioned Summer of Changsha, a Chinese film that had been banned from Cannes. Well, actually, it ended up, it played in a certain regard instead of where it was going to play. But the cast and the crew did not attend, and the film did not have the official censorship stamp, meaning it was been approved by the government. So it did play at Cannes. It was reviewed by critics, and the one critic who saw it from Hollywood Reporter had no clue as to why it was yanked, since they could discern no particular political content that would give it trouble. But it did end up playing, though it wasn't officially approved and the talent wasn't there. So, you know, that movie was at Cannes and was reviewed. And you mentioned Patrick J. Adams. That's an actor. He's returning to the TV show Suits for its final season, which if you watch Suits, you might care about. And that raises the question, will the princess show up? No, she will not.
Well, you know, speaking of Cannes and En Certain Regard, I saw the winner of that I saw it over the weekend, The Invisible Life of Eridice Guzmão. And it's based on a book, and it was absolutely phenomenal. It's a Brazilian film. And
this is one of the films that won a big award that you weren't able to see.
I wasn't able to see it, and I was able to catch up with it over the weekend, and this is a great movie.
Terrific. Oh, and by the way, she's not a princess. She's the Duchess of Sussex. I should get that right.
I don't even know what we're talking about anymore.
Well, Meghan Markle, who started on Suits, of course.
Oh, okay.
And now she's British royalty being insulted by the president of the United States as he comes and calls her a nasty woman, which
he then said he never said, even though it was actually recorded on television.
Well, of course. So that's cool. You know, there are 10 or 12 really good movies from Cannes that I want to see. So I think it was a banner year for the festival. But hopefully it'll be a banner episode for us. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've hit the lazy, hazy days of summer. Sure, the box office is heating up, but the news is a little quiet. Certainly, the big news is that writers and agents will sit down at the bargaining table this week. Neither side seems to have budged on their major issues, but neither side wants to be seen as refusing to talk either. And so they'll talk, or kibitz, as they would say at the legendary Beverly Hills restaurant, Nate Nall's. Mm-hmm. By the way, see episode 435 for that reference, okay? In sexual misconduct news, R. Kelly faces more criminal charges, while self-help guru Tony Robbins is paying a price for behavior he has apparently been getting away with for decades. And no, walking barefoot over coals won't make his problems go away. On Inside Baseball, Apple has decided you should be streaming music rather than buying it, or at least that's what their decision to shut down iTunes would signal, if it's true. We'll explain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Deadline, The Numbers, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, all the major dailies. You, our listeners, we depend on you for some of that information we can't find anywhere else. And the number one movie around the world last week was Godzilla, King of the Monsters. It opened to $180 million worldwide. Tracking was a little bit lower than people expected. You know, they thought every day it seemed like they were lowering expectations for this movie, but it did open up to $180 million. And of course, poor reviews of this series, this franchise, which has included Kong, Skull Island, and an earlier Godzilla flick. It's not been well reviewed. This one has opened up a little bit lower than the first two, but they ended up making about $500 million. If this one doesn't fall off a cliff, it should end up at about $500 million as well. But there are some early warning signs that they're a little nervous.
Yeah, I was talking to some people from throughout the industry this weekend, and they were shaking their heads saying, you know, it's kind of sad when a $50 million opening is a bad opening. But I guess when you spend $170 million on your movie, yeah, it's a bad opening.
When they're talking about the North American box office, and again, when they can say a couple weeks out, well, we're hoping for 60, and then it keeps, well, maybe 55, well, maybe 50, okay, $49 million, that's not a good sign. But one thing they're lucky about is that Hollywood hides the grosses. They don't like to talk about the money being made Monday through Thursday, even though during the summer, tons of money is being made. Because guess what? If you just drop the end, and instead of saying the number one movie last weekend was Godzilla, if you said the number one movie last week in North America, instead of saying Godzilla grossed $49 million and was the number one film at the box office, you would be saying Aladdin is the number one film last week. It grossed $93 million.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the...
it made more money Monday through Thursday, $52 or $51 million, than it did Friday through Sunday.
Yeah, if you looked at even this weekend, $120 million combined international, you know, worldwide gross, right? But then it's been out for 2 weeks, right?
Right.
So look at the worldwide gross to date.
Well, that's right. That's where you've hid the money that was gross Monday through Thursday. So if you do a little math, which I've done, guess what? Worldwide box office, the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row was actually Aladdin with $212 million. That is the number one movie last week at the box office. Now, again, these box office grosses have turned into PR for the studios, right?
Yes, everybody absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And so you want to boast the biggest number you can. That's why they throw those Thursday night grosses into Friday and pretend, oh, it's opening weekend, when in fact movies don't open on the weekend anymore. They want to boast the biggest number possible. Well, guess what, people? Why hide all that money? Talk about all the money made last week. When you talk about album sales, they don't just talk about album sales from Friday through Sunday. When they talk about book sales, they don't ignore book sales made Monday through Thursday. So when you're talking about movie grosses from the previous week, why in God's name you would shut your eyes and ignore the tons of money being made Monday through Thursday is beyond me.
Well, I think a part of it might be historic, right? So they're
not really, since it only started in the 70s. And again, if it was they cared about history, they wouldn't toss in the Thursday numbers.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that previously, you know, and actually more often than not, you don't have $90 million grosses in the middle of the week.
We just did a few weeks ago with Avengers Endgame.
Right. No, I agree with you.
You have
I think
big money
more and
all
more,
the time in the summer.
Well, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like, you know, at the Golden Trailer Awards this past week, they gave out a box office award. Well, who the heck do you think won it for like the fifth year in a row?
Disney.
That's right. It was Disney. So in other words, that award used to mean something and it doesn't mean anything anymore. So I think in this age of blockbusters, I would agree with you that the weekend doesn't matter so much. The week matters.
Especially when you talk about the Thanksgiving holidays, Christmas through New Year, which is a 10, 12 day span where there's tons of money being made. There's always something showing up. And again, movies open up on Thursdays now, not Friday. So the idea of hiding the box office, if we talked about the real worldwide box office, the number one movie 2 weeks in a row would be Aladdin. That would put Godzilla's Faltering, where it made $180 million in starker relief. Not great news for that studio, but those are the facts. And if you're trying to get people to go to the movies and they say, hey, Aladdin's number one 2 weeks in a row, made $93 million in North America last week. Sounds like a big hit. You make them more excited to go. At number three around the world, if you add in all the money, it's still Rocket Man. You know, it doesn't always change, but instead of saying it grossed $44 million, you get to say it grossed $50 million because it expanded to some new territories, including North America, where it had a solid opening gross over the last 4 days. At number
four, I think this film is going to play for a long, long time.
How nice. At number four.
See that? See how I did that?
No, that was nice. I like that. At number four around the world, in the true charts, it's Parasite, the terrific Korean film. But in fact, it's John Wick 3, which grossed $24 million worldwide. I'm sorry, which grossed $46 million worldwide when you add in all the money from Monday through Thursday around the world. So, I mean, I think we should just start doing this. Nobody else talks about the full box office from the previous week. It changes what movie is number one and number two and number three. We've got those numbers because we can just take the total grosses around the world, subtract last weekend's gross, and then you find out how much money it made all over the world Monday through Sunday. So I think it's fascinating. But going back to the charts provided by ComScore, if we haven't confused you too much, at number four around the world, according to ComScore, just looking at grosses over the weekend, is Parasite. The Korean Palme d'Or winner had a great big opening in that country, $24 million. And since it cost about $12 million to make, it's already in the black thanks to pre-sales all over the world. This is a big success story. And number five, of course, is John Wick. They're reporting $23 million over the last 3 days. But if you look at the last week, it's made $46 million. Even better news, but the total for that movie is $220 million worldwide. So the first film made about $76 million. The second film made $176 million. This one is going to make $276 or more. At number six is Pokemon Detective Pikachu. That made about $20 million over the last 3 days. That's approaching the $400 million mark. At number seven around the world is Ma, the Octavia Spencer horror flick. That opened up over the last few days. It made $21 million, most of that in North America, where it opened up on Thursday. Now, apparently, there's some holiday in China, I believe, and kids are out of school because like three or four mostly low-budget animated flicks seem to have opened up in China and elsewhere. At the top of the list is Doraemon, Nobita's Chronicle of the Moon Exploration. That made about $18 million over the weekend, but it's at $63 million. And looking at the exhibitor that's listed, I think this one has opened up in China. Funny thing, when I looked up this movie on Wikipedia, it mentions that this is the last Doraemon movie of the Heisei era. Now, of course, we are in the Reiwa era, which is the era of beautiful harmony. When an emperor retires or dies and a new emperor comes into place, it becomes a new era and is given a new name. I found it interesting that they would mention that in the context of an animated film, but maybe that has more cultural import than I realize. But if we look, scroll down the charts, a couple of the movies have opened up, probably in China. One is Happy Little Submarine Space Pals. That's a very low-budget Chinese animated film. It's the latest in a series. I think there's been at least four. That grossed about $3.4 million in China. And a little bit lower at number 16 is Shimajiro and the Fantastic Flying Ship. Another low-budget animated film. This one is from Japan, but it has a different name when it plays in China, and it grossed about $2.7 million. And also Thomas and Friends, Thomas the Tank Engine. He had a movie from 2018 called Big World, Big Adventures, the movie. That, too, seems to have been opening up in China, where it made about $2.4 million. So it looks like there's some holiday going on and kids are free to go to the movies and see crappy animated films. If you know what's going on, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And you can like our Facebook page, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Now, you know what? Maybe what you can do is let us know whether you've seen the movie Booksmart, because apparently it's getting rave reviews and nobody went to see it.
Well, I went to see it over the weekend. I thought it was pretty good. I can see why it sort of woke you up at a festival. You know, you see it in a festival and you've seen a lot of dour, serious films. It's fun to see a good, well-done comedy. The two leads are good. It was directed by a woman, starring women, written by women, has good girl power energy going for it, well acted. For me, there were some cliches I didn't like about the theater kids and some other like rich kids that were just a little too broad for the movie, but it got better as it went along. It was well directed, solidly acted, and then it stumbled a bit again at the end, being kind of dumb and big, but smarter than your average bear. Not a classic teen comedy to me, but certainly it's worth a look, I think. I also saw Godzilla, which was dumb and just plain dumb, not fun dumb like John Wick, and I saw Rocket Man.
Oh, what'd you think of Rocket Man?
Well, you know, it was a musical. It was an actual, honest to goodness, walk down the street, break into song, and start dancing musical. And it's kind of like a Western. They don't make many of them like that anymore, though movie musicals are sort of coming back into vogue. But one where you really just break into song, characters do it, it's just fun to see that. So I kind of cut it some slack just for that. Taron Egerton wasn't as great as I was hoping because I've liked him a lot in the Kingsman movies. I find him appealing. And it was pretty good. Certainly better than, I imagine, Bohemian Rhapsody, just from the trailers. I didn't see it, but I'm dissing it anyway. Not fair. But
well, you know what? I would argue with you about it, but it's not Saturday night, so it's not all right for fighting.
No, we're not going to argue. Back to the charts at number 9, just finishing up the top 10. The Secret Life of Pets 2 continues to open up overseas and made another $17 million. It's at $28 million and counting. It's going to open up in North America on Thursday because movies don't open up on the weekend anymore. And at number 10, Avengers Endgame, another $16 million over the last 3 days. But its total worldwide is now $2,713 million. It needs about $75 million to become the highest grossing film of all time without adjusting for inflation. It could crawl its way there. Maybe they'll do a reissue later in the year, adding in like some new footage or something, or just re-promote it before it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray, or they'll show both movies as a double feature. I don't know, but I think they'll want to do something to push it over the top. Why not when you're this close?
I think that Disney, which of course owns Marvel, has had taken its eye off the ball because they've been too busy opening that Star Wars Galaxy Land at Disneyland.
You think they took the eye off the ball?
I'm
what
kidding.
Way?
It was,
and actually what it grossed last week was $25 million. So again, sounds a lot better than $16 million, doesn't it? Scrolling down the list.
I think that's about how much that Galaxy's Edge probably grossed, given how much it costs to get into Disneyland and how much everything is in that Star Wars land.
That's right. So that's the box office chart. You know, what is this? What the heck does that have to do with anything? There we go. We covered Variety. Variety had a headline just like we were discussing last week. It says Rocket Man doesn't need to reach Bohemian Rhapsody's box office heights to be a success. And of course, neither did Bohemian Rhapsody. That only cost $50 million to make itself. So if it had grossed $200 million, it would have been a big hit rather than $900 million, almost $1 billion, which was just insane. So yes, that absurdly successful movie is not the benchmark for success for Rocket Man. It's a bold movie. I think it's a lot more interesting than a lot of films. It's pretty, you know, every time I got a little bored by some of the cliche stuff of rock star excess, they would do something interesting with the song or how they move the story forward. And I thought, hey, there you go. That's good.
You know, and I see Pain and Glory here is still making money down at the end of this list. And that was also a Cannes film. And, you know, you kind of said something as we led into box office, which, if I had seen The Life of Eurydice Guzmán at Cannes, it would have just put the year over the top hadn't seen it after Cannes.
But it does, because that film played at Cannes. So when you're looking at the crop of films that came from Cannes or that you had the chance to see, you have to give that credit. Is that like a 3.5-star, 4-star movie as well?
Yes. Really and the funny thing is, it's based on a book. I went to look at what the book is about. And yes, it vaguely resembles what the movie was about, but not really. I mean, I'm like, wow, okay, so you took a few things from the book, but why even bother calling it the same thing? It's like, okay, there are two sisters in it. Okay, I did not read the book.
So you're basing it on a blurb, so perhaps it captures the spirit of the book more than you realize.
Maybe.
Well, you know, Rocket Man ends, not to confuse us jumping back and forth here, but Rocket Man ends with some of the success of Elton John, and they ignore what to me is his biggest success of all, and that's the string of top 40 hits. He had a top 40 hit every year, every year, year after year, from 1970 to 1995. 26 years in a row, he had a top 40 hit, not a top 100 hit even. He made the charts with the song every single year for 26 years in a row. That's like Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak in baseball. Somebody will presumably, I guess, beat it someday, but it's just unbelievable. And
well, there is a line in that movie where he says, I'm responsible for 5% of all the record sales in the entire world. Right, well, that was at a time when record sales actually meant something.
And that was a peak year where he was, you know, he had like multiple number one albums. He was just putting out stuff nonstop and everything he touched was a hit and deservedly so. And frankly, in adult contemporary charts, he's had a top 40 hit every year from 1970 to 2006, 37 years. In a row, he had a hit 1 year after, never missed a year. I thought that era had ended because people were having these blockbuster albums and they would come out every 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know, and big tours. You know, the industry had changed, but now we're back to a sort of a loosey-goosey era where people put out singles and LPs and EPs willy-nilly. So you've got Drake here. He's on fire. He's had a big hit single every year for quite a few years now, but he'd have to go to 2036 with this track record before he could match what Elton John accomplished. Will he do it? We'll have to wait and see.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say that because there has been a lot of talk in the music industry over the past year about how if you do not release something every 18 months, that you're kind of forgotten.
Well, 18 months, people go 18 weeks, but I don't think that's true. I think that's creating there's something to be said for going away and coming back. If you're big and you're good, you don't have to have something out every 18 months. I don't think if Drake took a year off, people would suddenly be like, who the hell is that? I don't care. You know, that's silly. You're creating that's sort of that cycle where people burn themselves out like we see Elton John doing in the movie because they're afraid to take a week off, you know, and breathe. I don't think that's true, but that is certainly the pressure that is on them right now to constantly create stuff. And forget 18 months. It's more like 18 weeks. These people just don't go away. But they're not the only ones talking about stuff. The WGA is talking too, aren't they?
I am impressed at the way you moved into that story. Yes, the Writers Guild of America, the folks that, you know, write all of the TV shows and the movies, at least the ones made by Hollywood.
There are writers on every movie and TV show, including reality TV. So writers are there no matter where it's Hollywood or anywhere
right,
over the
but
world.
But in France, for instance, they do not have a writers' guild.
They have writers?
They do have writers, correct.
They don't have a guild for writers? Are you sure?
No, I found that out recently, actually. And it's kind of a bit of an issue to the point where I'm not going to say the name of the film because that would be unfair. But I ran into an old friend who used to be a journalist and a critic. Attending Cannes, there she was in Cannes again. She was there for her film, which was in Cannes.
Like then Francois Truffaut, turning from critic to artist.
Right. I then watch the film. Her name is nowhere to be seen.
Oh.
And that is because there is this auteur theory in you know, French cinema where the director has to have the credit for everything, even if there were other writers on the project.
That's not what auteurism means, that there's no writing credit. It just means the director is the author of the film, despite the fact that there are writers and actors and set designers and film composers and hundreds of people creating a film, but the director is considered the author of the film. But that's why he has the credit for director. That does not mean he demands that nobody else gets a writing credit. That's not what auteurism means.
Well, these days, when you look at the IMDb credits for some French films, you'll see many writers listed. But then when you actually watch the film, there's only one, and that's the filmmaker.
You're telling me why would they be listed on IMDb if they're not listed on the film?
There are many people that are listed on IMDb that aren't listed in the film, and sometimes you'll
see.
Such
as what? What are you talking about? Hollywood movies have people listed on IMDb who don't have credits in the film?
Very often, like the cast, when they're uncredited, it will say in
the parentheses. That's not what we're talking about.
Right.
We're not talking about somebody seen in the background of an old movie who turned out to become a star.
No,
later.
Like, you know, if they wind up kind of.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Canon.
If you're at IMDb and you know what Sperling is talking about and you can confirm this, let us know. He's already given you the info. So I understand the idea that somebody might Bigfoot people and not get them the credit they deserve. I understand that saying Elvis Presley taking a co-songwriting credit on songs that he didn't really contribute to. Some big pop stars do that. If you're telling me a film director forces them to give him some co-writing credit, I would understand that. But you're saying they buy a script from Joe Blow, They make the movie, and then Joe Blow's name is nowhere to be seen. That's happening in France a lot. Well, that's a scandal. But then you tell me somehow IMDb finds this out and puts his name back in the credits, even though he's not mentioned in the movie. How would that work? How would they find out about it?
I don't know. They should. No. People should write to. I'll find out. I will actually.
You're not making any sense. So
I will contact somebody at IMDb that I know, and I will ask how they.
But yes, if a writer sells a script and then doesn't see their credit on the film, they have no organizing body to adjudicate credits for films on writing the way Hollywood does. That is a problem.
Right. Well, here in the United States, there's the Writers Guild of America. They have a little dispute with the Association of Talent Agents, the very people that are meant to represent them. This dispute is over the packaging, mostly of television shows and television series.
And also the companies creating their own production companies. So they want to be your boss and your friend at the same time. Oh, correct. I'll negotiate with myself for your writing credit and how much money you gake.
Apparently, we did not do a very good job. You're not making any money. Now, the WGA West, Chris Kaiser, he's shopping a series with Endeavor Content, but no one asked to, you know.
So this became a point of controversy. People say, what a hypocrite. He's fighting for the WGA and they're claiming they want to go against agencies who have these production companies. And yet here he is making a deal. And the WGA, I think, properly said, number one, no one's been asked to not do business, or, you know, they're not saying don't do business with any of these entities. That has not been a stance of the WGA. Therefore, if you're doing business with them, that's not in contradiction to what we're asking for.
You know, right. And these companies exist.
There's money to be made. You want a business. We're not telling you should walk away from that. And in fact, the fact that you're trying to negotiate and challenge this system where you are personally benefiting from it to a degree, to me, is like Bernie Sanders saying, I want to raise taxes on rich people. So what if he's worth $2 million? That proves he really means what he says.
Well, in this case, what we have is, I guess Chris Kaiser is not going to walk away from either negotiating or his series. But at the same time, he now has to sit back down with the ATA on June 7th.
Not has to. He wants to.
He wants to, yes. Yeah, and I don't think it will be at Nate Nowles, by the way. FYI.
Probably not. Well, right. In less pleasant news, we have more sexual misconduct news, but it's good news in terms of legal justice. R. Kelly, the singer who has been facing a raft of accusations and, in fact, legal issues, has been hit with 11 more sexual assault-related charges by the legal system.
And by people who are under the age of 18.
Well, yes, he was charged with aggravated sexual abuse involving four victims, including three between the ages of 13 and 17. And now he is facing more sexual assault related charges in those cases that are coming to the courts. And remember, there was an actor that was dumped from Showtime's The Chi. And we knew that one of the women who had complained and got nowhere and eventually said, I'd rather be released from the show than work with him, which is kind of stunning when you're an actor in Hollywood looking for a break. That was an actress who played his girlfriend on the show. She was so uncomfortable. She brought her fiance onto the set and he would be with her whenever she had scenes with this actor. Well, they didn't mention at the time who the second woman was, but a later story mentioned who that was. It was the showrunner. The female showrunner of the show was complaining about the actor on the show. That is a person of power. You're the damn showrunner, and she had to complain about this guy, and they still wanted to keep him. That tells you how hard it is to change things in Hollywood when you are the damn showrunner and you can't get justice for when you're dealing with an actor who is, you know, behaving outrageously. So that kind of blew my mind. I don't know. But among other legal issues, Kevin Spacey's trial is moving closer. That may begin in October. That's a trial for sexual assault. And other people are not facing legal charges yet, but they sure are facing blowback. That's self-help guru Tony Robbins paying the price for decades of sexual misconduct. Who is he again?
Well, he is kind of like a self-help guru, a motivational speaker, and he was in Shallow Hal. I remember that much.
Okay.
He plays a pivotal part in Shallow Hal.
Right. And he has turned his public speaking skills into a media empire of books and motivational tapes and, of course, courses where you show up and pay him thousands of dollars or more to be inspired and motivated. He always struck me as the vibe of a used car salesman, why anybody would want to be around this guy. He just oozed dickishness in my mind. And his whole thing is, don't be a victim, got to be strong, which is really easy to say when you're a straight white male worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But anyway, he's really paying a price now. BuzzFeed did an extensive investigation into Tony Robbins. Apparently, they heard stories about him, and they did a multi-part series looking at how he has behaved presently and over his career. And they spoke to 9 former female staffers and followers. Even the fact that they would be called followers is creepy in my mind, accusing him of sexual misconduct, repeatedly pushing them to have sex with him, firing one woman after she had consensual sex with him, repeatedly groping them physically, exposing himself, staffers forced to work around him while he was naked, and on and on and on. So they have a lot of people on the record talking about what he's done. He's like, oh, if I ever, you know, offended anyone, I feel terrible. They have video of him using the N-word, but in context, it's not as bad as it sounds, though it's kind of still dickish. A lot of his shtick, you got to know, involves not seeing yourself as a victim, which, again, isn't hard when you're a straight white male multimillionaire. But anyway, he would berate women in his audiences who discussed being sexually harassed and or raped. As recently as 2018, a woman at one of his, you know, events said her husband was physically and emotionally abusive, and he scoffed at her. And he said, quote, does he put up with you when you've been a crazy bitch? In a separate incident, a woman said she had been raped, and Tony Robbins said to the Crown, she's effing using all this stuff to try and control men. I mean, that's just unbelievable. And you go, for years, people saw them and go, yeah, yeah. And now they're going, oh, wow, maybe that's kind of insane.
Well, and it is worth noting that there have been, and I'm not coming to Tony Robbins' defense at all.
Yes, you are.
I am saying that the reporting has been questioned in that story. And it's not the first time BuzzFeed reporting has been questioned.
We have video of him saying this stuff.
No, not the stuff that you were just talking about. I'm talking about all the accusations that were made. There have been people who were quoted in the story coming out and going, whoa, 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 you're taking that way out of context, or, you know, even filing cease and desist letters with BuzzFeed.
No, there was one woman who was an employee that with their lawyers came back to them and said that's I've seen, but the others, I haven't seen others. One woman who still works for him came back with his lawyers. Have you seen others? I know one woman who recanted what she said, but...
the woman that it must be the same woman then.
Right. Okay. So... that's not questioning. That's somebody who still works for him and suddenly realized.
She still works for him. So maybe it is a different woman. I don't know. Anyway.
Right. Well, what's happened is he had a book coming out from Simon & Schuster. He's had lots of books come out over the years, been big bestsellers. They have removed him from their release schedule. His people keep saying, no, the book's just been delayed, while Simon & Schuster says, no, we have no plans to ever publish this book. He has been dumped from his title as chief of investor psychology at a major wealth management company called Creative Planning. It's a $38 billion wealth management company. Though if they're spending money and having Tony Robbins as something dumb known as chief of investor psychology, some of that money is being wasted. Nonetheless, he had partnered with...
You're saying don't invest in that?
Well, I mean, position? Yeah, I mean, that's pretty dumb. But he has been partnered with one of the top people at Creative Planning. They had co-authored some, you know, financial planning books and stuff. That guy is distancing himself from Tony Robbins completely. But of course, he denies any fallout. And in response to the BuzzFeed article, he said if he ever said or did anything that offended anyone, of course, he apologizes.
Well, yeah. Okay. And that brings us to the Georgia law.
Yes. So again, sometimes
or the Georgia boycott, we should say.
Right. Why is this in sexual misconduct news? It's because if you don't treat people fairly on the set and in society, you're going to have more and more trouble like what we're talking about here. Don't work with jerks is a really good rule of thumb that Hollywood has ignored for most of its history. But now we have laws in Georgia and a few other states that are, you know, single out and attacking women and trying to take away their right to control their own bodies. Hollywood was trying to take a wait-and-see attitude, but Netflix sort of broke the barrier here. They spoke up and said what I thought was sort of milquetoast. They just sort of said, you know, we'll be thinking carefully if this law goes into effect about the business we do in Georgia. To me, it wasn't like they said, we're walking away or anything.
Well, they said they're going to try and help overturn the law.
Well, everybody said they don't approve of the law, and they've been donating money, et cetera, and things to work with the groups who are advocating against it in Georgia, the local groups. But to me, they just said, well, you know, just like all the studios said, they're hoping it'll just be stopped by the courts and they won't have to respond to it. But Netflix publicly said, you know, that will concern us. And because they went on the record, everybody else felt like they had to go on the record, and each statement became stronger than the one before. So now suddenly, a week later, we've got Netflix, Disney, NBC Universal, Sony, Warner Media, CBS, Viacom, and AMC, which films The Walking Dead in Georgia, and a friend of mine works on that show, all saying they would strongly reconsider filming in Georgia if these anti-woman bills become law and go into effect. They've all done significant work in the state. An indie producer, Miranda Bailey, just walked off a film project a month before shooting in Georgia called Time Capsule. That's paying a higher price because you know what? The studios can take their movie and TV show and work elsewhere, and they may pay a little higher cost. But when you're an indie producer and you fight hard to get a movie made and you walk away from a project, that's really paying a personal cost. So,
well, yeah, and you know, the studios, I don't want to say they're in a hard spot here, but
well, they'd rather not deal with politics, that's for damn sure.
Exactly. And here's the issue is that, you know, if they spend $30 million on a production, they really only have to spend 20 because there's a 30% tax break and a 30% rebate that they're basically getting
from the state of Georgia. That's how they've recruited so much business over the years.
So it is a financial decision to say we're not going to Georgia to shoot. So
right, so they may go to another state that offers 20% tax break or 50%. Right, well, yeah. So it's not that they're going to lose all that money necessarily, but it's a lot of money that's being spent. $2.7 billion in direct spending annually is estimated for Georgia. It creates at least 92,000 direct jobs in the state.
That's a lot.
And then that, you know, extrapolates out. I have another friend in Georgia who has a great cafe in Atlanta. It's called Petit Chou. You know, Little Cabbage, Petit Chou ATL, terrific little restaurant. And he doesn't cater film sets and he doesn't depend on the film sets, but they often mention the cast and crew people that they spot in the show, coming to their cafe and having lunch or dinner there. So, you know, local businesses like that get extra business because there are people in town. People live in Georgia because they move there to work.
Who lives in Georgia?
I mean, film people there permanently, yes, because there is enough work to support you. And they said, hey, you know, guess what? So this is a real serious thing. And credit to Netflix for speaking out and going on the record and forcing all the other studios to do it. And of course, some of the dumb right wingers in Georgia say, we don't need you to tell us how to live our lives. But it really will have a serious major impact on the state if they walk away. And some other people say, well, this is no way to pressure them into doing what you want. You know, it's like, no. That's exactly how you pressure people. You say you're going to pay a price. We will take our business elsewhere. You're free to pass the laws you want. And we're free to say we don't want to work in a state that does that.
Well, if you think that story is a big deal, I wonder what you'll think of some of the stories in our Big Deal, Big Whoop segment. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, Broadway is just going to hell. Okay, not exactly, but Hadestown, that's where they're going. That's the name of the new hit musical, which Michael predicts will win the Tony for Best Musical. It's certainly tearing it up at the box office, joining the Million Dollar Club and increasing in grosses virtually every single week since it began previews. Also, right up there is the Temptations musical Ain't Too Proud and the play To Kill a Mockingbird. They're just the biggest success stories in a 2018-2019 theater season that has proven one for the record books. In total, Broadway grossed $1.8 billion and attendance hit 14.7 million people. Every 7 years, the theater season includes 53 weeks instead of 52, but even if you take out the final extra week, this year still set records in attendance and grosses. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You just answered our question, didn't you? It is a very big deal. It's been growing thanks to tourism in New York, and tourism is growing thanks in part to Broadway. Lots of new shows all the time, shows with names that people recognize, you know, whatever you think of Pretty Woman and Tootsie, people have heard of them. You know,
well, apparently Tootsie's quite good. People like Tootsie.
Yeah, no, I was mixed on it, but I loved the film. I felt the show was sort of a missed opportunity. It did not quite nail it, but it certainly got good reviews and is doing solid box office. But Hadestown and Ain't Too Proud are really tearing it up. So, you know, they are the bigger success stories for sure. But Tootsie will have a solid run.
More women are reviewing movies than ever before. That's the good news. But according to a study of those listed on Rotten Tomatoes, they still make up just 34% of critics. The news is even worse, anecdotally, in theater, where women make up some 60% of ticket buyers, but even less than one-third of the critics. When it comes to moviegoing, the assumption is that guys on dates defer to the tastes of women. And of course, women make up a majority of the population. Does it matter who reviews a movie? Well, the same study says women are more likely to refer to a female director by name and reference earlier work by them, thus giving those directors more gravitas than those whose earlier work is not mentioned at all. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop.
Yeah, I'd agree.
You know why? Because it's based on a glancing at Rotten Tomatoes. You know, come on, put a little work into it. That took about 5 minutes to do. That's not a study. That's me scrolling through the internet and bored.
Wait a second. Didn't you say it was kind of the dog days of entertainment news right now? That you had to find
that's
a story?
That's true, but we're writing a story about a study of the people randomly listed on Rotten Tomatoes is pretty low-hanging fruit. It's got to be hard to track down who are critics and noteworthy. That might have been a good place to start, but that should not have been where you stopped in terms of female critics.
That's YouTuber PewDiePie you're seeing in the rearview mirror, Michael.
See ya, PewDiePie.
The Swedish personality and the Indian channel T-Series were both gunning to become the first YouTubers to notch 100 million subscribers. PewDiePie had been the most popular YouTuber for 6 years running, but T-Series passed him up. The channel focuses on music videos and movie trailers in the Indian market and has been growing in popularity by leaps and bounds.
I follow them.
The competition with PewDiePie helped both of them turbocharge subscribers, but PewDiePie is now at 96 million while T-Series has hit the magical 100 million number. Hey, have you seen the music video for Isla Ray, the first song to be released from the upcoming film Malal? And were those two titles just put in to trip me up?
And
big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. You know, it's just a marker, a moment in time, but it is noteworthy. 100 million subscribers for one YouTube channel. That's how much of an audience goes to YouTube every single day. And that's how big the market is in India, which is why everybody wants to do business there.
Apparently, not everyone was upset about the finale of Game of Thrones. Its creators David Benioff and D.B. Weiss are looking to sign a new overall TV deal. First, they are working on a trilogy of Star Wars movies. And first, they fired their manager. Yes, right after their HBO series ended, the duo parted ways with their management company of 20 years. They had fine words about Guyman Cassidy's ability to spot material. He did, after all, connect with them with George R.R. Martin's novels. And they also said how they're looking forward to the next stage of their relationship with Guyman. But that relationship with their long-term manager won't include being their manager. Big deal or big whoop?
This always makes me feel very unhappy. You know, you have your big success and then you dump the person that was with you before you were. That always makes me feel very poorly about somebody. I don't know these guys from Adam. They've had good success with Game of Thrones. Good luck for them. But when you look at what they accomplished before that, they were getting work and things were being made, but they certainly weren't clicking. They did Troy. That's a bad epic film. They did The Kite Runner, which is a piece of junk. They did the flop Wolverine film, which wasn't a disaster, but it was not a success story. They did Brothers, which starred Tobey Maguire and got made, but it was not a success commercially or critically. They did the modest Spike Lee hit 25th Hour, based on Benioff's novel. And they have upcoming, to be fair, but that's in the wake of Game of Thrones. They have Ang Lee's Gemini Man, which, frankly, the trailer leaves me pretty uninterested, but you know, you never know, and it is Will Smith, so that could click, and I'm interested. I will go see it. But that is a lot of stuff that didn't work, that their manager stood by them. They finally click with a show based on a book that he brought to them, and then they dump him practically the first chance they get. That does not make me like people.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately when it comes to writers and managers, rather than agents, remember, they're different, okay? There is a difference there.
Yes, there is, yeah.
I think that there might be the feeling of, well, why do I need a manager? I don't need a manager now. I've got, you know, people coming to me. So I think
right,
that
so
might
they help
be part
you get
of
to the
thinking.
Point where you have success and then you dump them. Yeah. I understand now that they've helped you become a hit. You don't need them as much. Sure, I get that. But they helped you become a hit. And they should share it. And they're like, well, he shared in plenty of rewards. He's been getting 10% for all the Game of Thrones now, and I'm done with him. Yeah, it's just as ugly. If you felt you needed a manager before, you probably still need manager again.
Well, and a manager is meant to do more than just find you a job. In fact, a manager is not supposed to be negotiating employment contracts.
Well, we didn't say they were.
Right.
They're helping them get work or finding the right projects to help them have a great
career.
That's
what they're supposed to, And by the way, they get 15%, not 10%.
Well, it depends on the manager.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences named the latest batch of honorees for its Governor Award. Seen as a career capper, the artists used to be brought out for applause. Remember that? When they would be brought out during the Oscars?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been Doris Day, but she kept saying no thank you. They would have loved to give an award to Doris Day. I wish she had said yes.
Now they've got their own show, and the honorees on October 27th will be Cherokee American actor Wes Studi, four-time actor nominee. Actor nominee? No, he's going to be an Oscar nominee. He was a four-time Oscar nominee for director David Lynch and Italian director Lena Wertmüller, who made history in 1975 as the first woman to be nominated for Best Director. Oscar-winning actress Gina Davis gets the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award for her work encouraging diversity and fighting gender bias and stereotyped roles throughout the business. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the people involved, obviously. I still wish they had their moment in the spotlight at the Oscars. I thought it was a great part of the show. Among the many, many people they might have chosen, you know, these, you know, who knows what, who should have been chosen that wasn't, but these all seem like worthy, reasonable, good choices. Wes Studi is a legendary actor who has been in 1,000 really good films, so he is worthy of the spotlight. David Lynch still has got some great work ahead of him, perhaps, but he's certainly a notable talent. Lena Wertmüller had a legendary impact on the business. And Gina Davis, I didn't know about her work. So there you go. But two men, two women, fighting diversity, breaking down stereotypes in terms of depictions of Native Americans on the big screen. Seems like a good roundup of people to me.
What was the 1975 film that Lena Wertmüller was nominated for?
It's not Swept Away. It's Is it Seven Beauties?
Yes, it was.
Ah, well, it is? Oh, okay, good.
Oh, wait, actually, maybe it was the 1974 film.
No, it was 75, I think. Or maybe that was the year she was nominated or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, what are the films right around then? I'll recognize it if
you
say.
Well, Swept Away and Seven Beauties.
It must be Seven Beauties then. I know it's not Swept Away, I think.
Well, now we're going to have to go look it up.
Oh, well, keep talking.
Well, all right, fine. I'm not going to talk, though. I'm going to sing because here comes Santa Claus, Michael. Here comes Santa Claus right down Santa Claus Lane. Okay. Now, that was fair use, by the way. But if we actually sang that whole song, some money would go to the publishing company that owns the rights, that holiday classic. It's by Gene Autry, by the way. You knew that. Yeah. As of a few days ago, that would be Warner Chappell. Yes, the four publishing entities overseen by the Gene Autry Music Group have been snapped up by Warner Chappell. In all, the catalog includes some 1,500 songs. We're going to do a segment of each and every one of them right now.
Back in the Saddle Again.
Yes, that's right. It includes Back in the Saddle Again, written by the singing cowboy himself, Gene Autry. Big deal or big whoop.
Someday we'll do an all musical episode. It'll be so exciting.
I'm going to get a stunt man for that one.
I would say this is a big deal. I can't believe the catalog was still available. Frankly,
neither could I.
I guess it was privately held and they just didn't bother.
Well, I think, Gene Autry's widow passed away. And I think she owned the Angels, the Los Angeles Angels.
Yeah, she just wanted to hold on to it. Why did she want to sell it?
I don't know.
No reason, right? So now that she's gone, it's being sold off. So I am surprised it was sold. I'm a little surprised that none of the stories mentioned the price. I couldn't find what they paid for it anywhere, which I found a little puzzling and interesting. But I can tell you about a little confusion, my mistake on Lena Wertmüller. The film Seven Beauties came out in 1975. She was nominated for an Oscar for her directing on that movie. That happened in 1977. So that's when she made history in a way.
Okay. Well, now it is time for Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I just did a quick check, and nope, there's no update on this. So let's do the story as if it's true, because it would be the end of an era before the iPod, when Napster was turning casual music fans into criminals. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Apple saved the music industry by launching iTunes. Of course, the music industry at the time was suspicious. They feared iTunes was just a way for people to organize all that music they'd stolen, which, by the way, it kind of was. When Apple marketed it with the tagline "Rip, Mix, Burn," their suspicions deepened. And yes, like I said, at first, iTunes was primarily a way for fans to organize the digital tracks they ripped from the compact disc they owned.
Yeah, that's what I did with it.
Yeah, or you know, they borrowed those CDs from friends or the library. I mean, you know. But it also gave people an easy way to actually buy music again, especially singles. For $1, you could buy a song and start playing it almost instantly. With that as an option, suddenly going to black market sites and maybe downloading a virus along with that hit song didn't seem to be so appealing. But now that iTunes seems to have outlived its purpose, Apple will launch new apps to handle music, video, books, and podcasts. And the once iconic all-purpose library known as iTunes will disappear.
Well, there's a lot going on here. First of all, is the fact that Apple is trying to say we're not just a hardware company. They want people more and more to see them as a services company. They want your monthly fee for Apple Music. They want your monthly fee, perhaps, for Apple TV, or at least they want you to come to Apple TV all the time. So now iTunes is sort of, it's an all-purpose department store where it has everything gathered in one big lumpy place, and it's kind of sludgy. And now they're saying, all right, we're going to have apps just for movies. We're going to have apps just for TV and video, I should say. We're going to have apps just for music and an app just for books and an app just for podcasts to make them streamlined and focused and easier to use. And also to make you think, ah, yes, go to my Apple app for music, Apple app for books, Apple app for this and that, and see them as a company that offers all that stuff. And in fact, even as we're talking, they have just released the first trailer for one of their TV shows. It's an alternate history of the space race overseen by Ron Moore. And the TV show is called For All Mankind. And they've just dropped a trailer. So now Apple's saying, hey, TV shows from Apple. You know, that's a new idea that they've never really done before, but they've got it.
Well, and the keynote address at the Worldwide Developer Conference that Apple holds each year is taking place literally as we record this.
Right. So, and that's where they're going to announce the fact that they're moving away from iTunes to these dedicated apps that they say, and of course they will, work better. For a long time, techies have complained that iTunes is stodgy and slow and all this stuff. I use it all the time. I never think twice about it. It works fine for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be disappointed if they did away with it. What would I do with all my MP3s?
Well, they would go to you would just click on your music app. Instead of going to a site where you'd have your music plus books plus video plus whatever, it would just be one app that would handle it. It'll be more integrated with the music service that they offer, Apple Music, and it'll be, I'm sure, just as easy to use as the one they had. But that was the big thing about iTunes. It was easy, and you could buy songs for $1. As we talked about in the past, the record industry walked away from the single. They were so excited to have you pay $15, $17, $18 for a compact disc, they got rid of the single. So kids who just wanted to buy a hit song and didn't want to buy the album or sense that the album was going to be junk, maybe they just wanted to buy Old Town Road. They didn't want to buy the Lil Nas X album, not that there is one, but they said, I just want to buy that.
Is there one? I don't
know.
Not
yet, not yet. I just want to buy that song, and I don't want to buy everything else because I'm not thinking that guy's, you know. They couldn't do it. For years, they made it really hard for you to buy singles, which sounds crazy because that's how young kids get in the habit of buying music and listening to music and becoming fans of an artist. But they said, we're done with that. We want you to pay $18 for albums on compact disc. And so suddenly fans were forced, if they wanted to buy digitally or they wanted to buy just a song, they had no choice but to steal. They were forced to steal by the stupid record labels, and they went to Napster. And so Apple said, hey, let's make this easy for them again. It was so easy to buy a single again, so easy and simple and cheap that it wasn't worth your bother to become a thief. People didn't want to steal. They were forced to steal. And then when they went to Napster, they said, wow, this works really, really well. And that's why iTunes kind of helped save the record industry, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it did. It certainly brought the single back.
Yeah, it did. And the funny thing is, they did not like the idea of streaming. You know, right when iTunes launched, what was it called? Pandora? That was around, right? The idea of paying.
Yeah, but the whole thing was that they wouldn't allow more than a 30-second clip of music, a 30-second sample of music to be on iTunes.
Well, unless you bought it.
Well, yeah.
But right, of course. Correct. They did not want you to stream music. They wanted you to buy it. Steve Jobs, smart in a lot of ways, did not envision a world where people would pay a monthly fee to have access to an entire library of music more than they could ever purchase in a lifetime. He didn't think about that. He thought that would never work. He thought nobody wanted that. He couldn't even more so, he couldn't think about TV and movies because, of course, downloading and streaming wasn't as easy then. But you peek into the future and you think, yeah, you know what? A monthly fee to access all the movies and TV shows made, I'm never going to buy all them. I can't possibly buy all them. So I actually would like the idea of a monthly streaming fee. They might have done that way back when, and help the industry segue into where it is today a lot sooner and a lot easier. and a lot more profitably. But because Apple said no to streaming and yes to purchasing, that day got delayed for a long, long time. Hey, nobody's perfect.
Well, you know what, though? In Steve Jobs' defense, and frankly, in well, not his defense necessarily, but, you know, maybe change had to come in baby steps. People were already questioning, do I buy an album digitally? I mean, I don't have anything to hold. I don't have anything, you know, where are my liner notes?
Right, but Napster already showed you the future, and they ran screaming from it. And they were able to delay the day, but it has finally arrived. So if you're talking about getting people to pay a monthly fee and talking about getting people, like they pay a cable subscription fee to have access to all those cable channels, it's the same idea. You know, that was not a new crazy idea back in the 90s. You know, if they talk about that and they had switched to there earlier, we might have a lot more people paying a monthly fee, and thus the business might be back to where it was in the heyday or even bigger. And, you know,
yeah, possibly.
One of the things people complain about is that when streamers like Spotify and these go into other countries, they're charging less for a monthly fee. You're not going to pay $10 in India when people's daily wages are much lower. They're charging like $2 or $1.50 or something like that for a monthly fee. So that means worldwide, the cost of, you know, signing up new subscribers, they're paying less and less into the kitty. But you know what? If you get a billion people to pay $5 a month, well, now you've got $5 billion a month to split up among everyone. That's $60 billion a year. You know, that's real money. So, you know, songwriters aren't getting enough money. Musicians aren't getting enough money. Streamers are taking perhaps more than they deserve since they have no business unless the music is created. But, you know, they need to sign up a lot of more streamers. And if it's a lower cost to do that, so what? If you get enough people, that's the whole dream, right? To get enough people signed up so that we can make more money than we were back in the day when we were selling compact discs. And that day may have been delayed because they saw Napster and they ran screaming in the opposite direction.
Correct. And I'm looking through the live blog that The Verge did on...
Still nothing. Well, it's not official yet.
Yeah,
That's what you're saying.
It doesn't seem to be official that they're killing it. So who knows? Maybe this was all just, like I said, it's the slow time of the year for news. Let's make it up.
No, a lot of people have sourced the fact that they're going to have apps and this and that. It's not like what Apple might do. This is sources have said this is what they're doing. So the cat is out of the bag pretty strongly, I think, on that one. And of course, it's no secret that some people died last week, including an odd, eccentric artist who was there before compact disc and is still there today.
Yes, Leon Redbone died at the age of 69. He kind of was a real, what would you say, eclectic kind of guy?
Well, yeah, he was an oddball. He had a sort of a persona. I would say he's the flip side of Tiny Tim. Both of them loved music from the 20s and 30s, and they both became very unlikely celebrities. Tiny Tim had this outrageous big personality, and Leon Redbone had this sort of mysterious, you didn't know how old he was, you didn't know where he was from, you didn't know who his family was, but he became a bit of a celebrity.
Yeah, and he always kind of wore this hat and glasses. He kind of had a Panama hat, I guess.
Mm-hmm, yep, yep.
I don't think his biography was actually true.
He made out crazy, crazy details about his life. But there he was, the first season of Saturday Night Live. It wasn't as easy to book musical guests in that first year because nobody knew what the show was or who would watch. He was on the show a couple times in that first season alone. And he was on Johnny Carson a lot after that. He got championed by everyone from Bob Dylan back in the 70s to Jack White today, who has reissued some of his music. And, he's got some really good albums, especially in the 70s in his heyday for Warner Brothers. And the nice thing is, instead of saying, oh, do I want to go? Maybe I'll hear a song on the radio, or maybe I'll go out and buy a compact disc. Today, the second you hear about he's dead, if you've been familiar with him or want to check him out, you can go to YouTube and type in his name and see one of his performances on Saturday Night Live. Or you can go to your streaming service and download a couple of his classic early albums from the 70s, which is what I did. So I think it's a great new world that we're in terms of access to music. It's a little overwhelming at times, but it's pretty cool when you can hear about somebody, become intrigued, and in 5 minutes, you're listening to a really good album.
Would you say it's a whole new world?
I would. I can't know the next line. A whole new world. We really are going to have a musical. I don't know. We're halfway there, Sprung. We're more than halfway to the end, but we do have listener email.
And yeah, I want you to actually sing this email.
I will read it to you. It's from a listener of the show.
And it was sent to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, DIRT@showbizsandbox.com.
Thank you. Yeah, you should do the same right after you've rated and reviewed the show on iTunes. But it's been sent in anonymously because it deals with stuff in their part of the industry that they work in, so they don't feel comfortable being open. But we're happy to do that. They sent a link to a story in The Columbian, and the story is about the AMC movie chain buying up the indie movie chain Cinetopia. That's a four-location company that has been locked in legal battles with AMC over the controversial practice of clearances. That's where big chains refuse to carry a film unless they get exclusivity in certain areas, and smaller chains are denied access to the film as well. Cinetopia was suing AMC over that issue. They've been in the courts, and now suddenly, out of nowhere, AMC has bought the chain outright. Cinetopia, you might know, helped pioneer the fancier dine-in food service. They didn't originate it. There were brew taverns back in the 70s or 80s, I think, but they carried it to a new level of classiness. And AMC themselves has copied that idea. They've got 40 AMC locations around the country that are called dine-in services. And that includes right here in Birmingham, Alabama at the Vestavia AMC. I haven't been there yet for that. They just did the renovations a few months ago and opened up as a dine-in service, which means you can get food at your table, but they only have like 40 seats and a screen. Every time I think about going there to see what it looks like, the darn thing is mostly sold out. But anyway, here's what our listener had to say about this story. Quote, "The fact AMC in the end was likely forced to purchase the Cinetopia locations begs many questions. Why did they buy Cinetopia? Our listener suggests AMC paid out big bucks to end the lawsuit because they knew the court was going to find in favor of Cinetopia and reveal that clearances do take place and are anti-competitive. I don't know if the court would have ruled it was anti-competitive as such. I don't know if that was the issue. Well, I guess maybe they would have. Well, anyway, back to our listener's comment. The purchase of Cinetopia on the eve of a court action would indicate that AMC was in the wrong. In place of clearances being acknowledged in court, the chain had to bend over backwards." And he's talking about them buying the company outright, perhaps for a premium. No story has mentioned what they paid for these four locations, but our listeners suggest AMC paid a really big price, maybe even double what the locations are worth. Quote, "If it was discovered clearances were being practiced in that market, a full industry review would likely be in consideration. And I imagine AMC and the distributors would do anything to avoid that happening." He goes on further, this person, to talk about what they've discovered in terms of EU and other territories and the differences in the terms that are being played. They said they were talking with a lot of people about this at CinemaCon. Quote, "In many EU countries, the conditions for exhibitors are very different. This is specifically in countries where the VPF, the virtual print fee, is over. For example, all cinemas in the EU, no matter the size, or even if they are community run, have access to content on the day of release." I didn't know that. I guess that means even if you're tiny.
And that might be debatable. I would be interested to know whether that's true in every single country.
Well, perhaps not. But if it's in many of them, that's kind of crazy to know that you're a community run theater and you can get, you know, Avengers Endgame, a print of it, and demand it and get it. That's kind of crazy. I wouldn't have imagined that ever. So if that's happening anywhere, that's news to me. That doesn't happen anywhere in the U.S. or North America, does it?
No. I mean, you pretty much have to be allocated a print.
Right.
You have to, it depends, you know, when allocation is done, that's when all of these clearance issues arise right. Here in North America.
This person
North
goes
America.
On to say that in the EU, percentages, meaning the cut that the studios take back, start at 45%, not 55 or 60%. They say there is a huge disparity between exhibitor conditions in different parts of the world. I think we knew that, but it's important to point that out. And certainly some of this I didn't know. Again, they say, now that film is digital, there is no logical reason to restrict access to content. How long before you see this coming to a head in the U.S.? Now, Michael Sperling would be very reluctant to discuss this topic. He has a conflict of interest, as does the listener. So please, Michael, give this a whack in the next podcast. Ask Sperling the questions and watch him squirm. All right. All right, Sperling, what the hell? What do you think about this?
You can't see me squirm because we're all audio only.
Thank God for that. So clearances, that's the perhaps anti-competitive and perhaps illegal practice of demanding exclusivity and making a competitor pay a price because you say, we're big, we want to carry this movie. Don't give it to that little tiny company, Cinetopia, in our market, or we won't carry your film.
Right, and there has been issues with clearances for as long
as... So it happens.
It definitely happens.
And is not necessarily illegal, or is it shady?
Ah, there's the rub. And I would say there is no definitive answer to that question.
Which is why this court case was so important and why it's fascinating to see the case come to an end, because AMC has suddenly purchased Cinetopia.
It wasn't actually an end to the case. What was going to happen was that both parties, AMC and Cinetopia,
have agreed to a settlement.
Yeah, well, they said, we're agreeing to a settlement and we'll let you know Friday what that settlement is. And instead of saying, oh, here's the settlement, it was, oh, actually, AMC just bought us.
But the court case is over now.
The court case thus ending the court case.
So, yes, that ended the case.
Yes.
What part of that was not true? We said it's ended the case. And he said, no, not really.
No. In the letter, in the listener email, it kind of made it seem as if there was going to be a ruling.
If they hadn't settled the case. They settled out of court. That's the whole point. There would have been a ruling. It was in court. There would have been a ruling, but they settled out of court instead and ended the case. There would have been a ruling. They were at court suing each other.
The ruling would have been that there was a settlement and that settlement.
No, the ruling would have been, if they didn't settle, the ruling would have been whether this was an illegal practice or not. Cinetopia and AMC were in the court suing each other. The case was in process. A judge ultimately would make a ruling, but now that's been short-circuited by AMC simply buying them outright. Just like in another case where they don't want to open their books, so they throw a lot of money at people to make the problem go away because they don't want to reveal the dishonest accounting practices that take place in Hollywood all the time. So there's nothing in that letter that's inaccurate.
Well, other than on the eve of court action, there was no court action. That was,
oh, for God's sakes, get over the eve. It doesn't matter. The judge was ultimately going to make a ruling. Maybe the judge was about to make a ruling. How do you know? Did you study the court case?
I called the judge and I spoke
with
him.
So you're arguing about something that's ridiculous. You've wasted 5 minutes talking about the word eve. The judge ultimately would make a ruling, and now they're not going to because AMC ended the court case and settlement by simply buying them outright and saying, well, what if we just bought you? Well, all right, how much? Okay, we'll take that check. Because one of the people who founded Cinetopia has opened up a new chain that's even higher dining, even more upscale than the sort of, you know, hamburgers and stuff. I mean, it's good food, I guess, in general, these places I've been to. Yeah, it's pretty good food, but I think they're now going for an even nicer, more elegant, classier sense of dining with even better food standards. And they have a new, independent exhibitor doing that. And so they're like, all right, we fought you in court, we're running out of money.
Yeah, and it's an independent exhibitor's biggest nightmare and biggest hurdle is getting the prints.
I mean, I find that confusing because I assume we know that the big chains account for about half of all the theater screens in North America. The other half are mostly in markets where the big chains don't want to play. They're in small towns or they're in areas where it's just not worth opening up a 20-screen megaplex, or they would do that. And those chain little guys would go out of business. Because
let's look at Hollywood is a great example of clearance because you have Arclight.
That's a city where there's so many people that can support chains large and small and art houses and things like that. I'm thinking about
and yet they still have clearances. There is still clearance in Hollywood.
There are fights over it. Yes.
Yes.
Right, but I'm saying most of the cases, I would think you're in a small town where a studio doesn't want to open up a chain, or I mean an exhibitor, a big one like AMC, Regal, or Cinemark. And so why do they care if Avengers Endgame goes to that little guy? They're not competing with them.
Well, they're just trying to put all competition out of business. And in this case, they did a good job.
Uh-huh. Well, now they've turned them into AMC locations. They've gotten into the Portland area where AMC at least wasn't there before, though I think you said Regal is.
Regal is, yes.
Yeah, so now they're competing with Regal. Regal is competing with AMC rather than Cinetopia. So I appreciate him, this person. I keep saying him. I'm assuming that, but I shouldn't because I don't even know who wrote it. You got the email. But this person wrote in, and I'm sexist, and I apologize for that. But it's good for – there probably aren't a lot of women in the exhibitor business, are there?
No, there are. I mean, but
– yeah,
but
like 30%, 20% when you go to
a
convention?
That's a good question. I would say it's definitely less than 50%, and it might even be less than 20%.
Wow, so there aren't that many people. So 80 to 90% of the people in the business are probably men. At least when you go to a convention or a thing, that's what you're looking at. Mostly men.
Right, correct.
All right,
yes,
well, that's sad. That's got to end. But I'm fascinated by this idea that even a community-run place in some EU countries can get access to a print, can demand it. You can't say no to them. That's interesting. I'd love to learn more about that. There's a lot of interesting stuff. The percentages really are that much better for exhibitors in the EU?
Yeah, but there might be actual laws.
No,
about
we don't
that.
Care why. Know, we don't care why. I know that there are. Stop pretending to. Well, it's just because there's a law. So the if the United States passed a law, there'd be much better terms for exhibitors in the U.S. as well. We understand that, but in the EU, there's a lot better terms for exhibitors than there are in North America.
But everybody kind of knew that, that, you know, internationally, you know, roughly between 40
France.
And 50.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the UK, and there are tax reasons for this. And
yeah,
so there's
a big difference between 45 and 60%. And if you want
right.
a healthy
and that's,
business.
I can't imagine that for Avengers Endgame, Disney did not go in at 55%.
Oh, really?
I mean, that's. Yeah,
well,
I mean, that's just...
If somebody knows that, in fact, Disney did not get those terms in any EU country, and they have direct knowledge of that, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
I sure wish people would rate and review our show, don't you? Do it while
I
you
do.
Still can on iTunes. You've only got
by
one
way,
brief week left in order to rate and review us on iTunes. This is your last damn chance, people. And yes, those reviews will carry over to whatever new app they do, but it would take you 10 seconds to go to iTunes and click on 5 stars. And if you wrote a sentence or two, that would be even sweeter. But this is your chance. This is your final chance to rate and review us on iTunes while it still exists.
By the way, just a heads up. Universal no longer grants exhibition clearances. So, and that's in large part because of the investigation the Justice Department was doing into whether clearances were legal or not. They never came to any conclusion.
Oh, it looks like
thus far.
Oh, God, it looks like the guy in Jeopardy has finally lost.
What?
James Holzhauers. It's just is breaking news, people. Breaking news.
Okay.
So you're saying one studio officially will not.
Universal Pictures
will not allow big chains to Bigfoot small chains.
Correct.
And why haven't the others followed suit?
I have no idea.
Huh? You would think if they felt legally obligated that the others would feel the same. Interesting. But they can still rate and review our show, can't they?
That's right. On iTunes, for now. The Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our show. And please do rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do. I mentioned those ways to contact us. You can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. In fact, on showbizsandbox.com, you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is MGMT.com. Every week, Michael Giltz has a new and exciting website. What is it this week, Michael?
This week, it's georgiasonmymind.com. I've got friends who work in the business there. I've got friends who have businesses that... So this is a really important issue to me. Georgia's blowing up there in the film industry, and they're being morons about it for no good reason.
And if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.